Part 3. How to Control Zombies. The only sure bulwark of continuing liberty is a government strong enough to protect the interests of the people, and a people strong enough and well enough informed to maintain its sovereign control over the government. Franklin D. Roosevelt. Once a nation of zombies has been created, the population must be kept docile and under control. This can be done through legislation and regulations, increasing police powers, and drugging the food and water supplies. But many commentators have written about how so many Americans become zombie-like while sitting mesmerized before their TVs for more than 8 hours a day. Between September 2007 and September 2008, the average household watched TV for more than 8 hours a day, a record high since the 1950s when TV viewer polls first began. In the third quarter of 2008, Americans watched more than 142 hours of TV a month, up 5 hours from the same period in 2007. What is most essential to control is that the zombies are unaware that they are being controlled. This, of course, would require controlling the mass media. Could this be happening in the United States, home of the First Amendment, and with a proud heritage of a free press? Media control and fear-mongering. The Internet has done a marvelous job of bringing alternative news and information to the people, but it has only done that for those who own and can use a computer. Everyone else is at the mercy of the corporate-controlled mass media, whether it be broadcast, cable, or satellite. America's mass media is currently in the hands of only 5 major multinational corporations: AOL Time Warner, the Walt Disney Company, Viacom, Vivendi Universal, and News Corporation. Media mogul Ted Turner once observed, "The media is too concentrated. Too few people own too much. There's really 5 companies that control 90% of what we read, see, and hear. It's not healthy." Not to mention Bertelsmann AG, which has become the largest English-language print publisher in the world and has roots in Nazi Germany. The face of the media has changed considerably since 1975, when cable TV served less than 15% of the viewing population and satellite TV and the Internet did not even exist as we know them today. More than 30 years later, less than 15% of American homes don't have either satellite or cable TV, and 1/3 of the population receives its news through the Internet. Government-dictated news. Far too often, the relationship between the government and the media corporations shapes what the news covers. As technology blurs the distinction between print and electronics, the success of media businesses depends increasingly on the decisions of government, embodied in regulations, legislation, and judicial rulings, explained Leo Bogart, who died in 2005, a former media studies fellow and general manager of the Newspaper Advertising Bureau. This must make people who run them more sensitive to the political effects of their news coverage, as political advertising has become a considerable component of television revenues. Politicians have found it increasingly necessary and expedient to court the media, creating a new source of pressure on journalists. Media reformist Robert McChesney agreed with Bogart, writing, "Professional journalism is now about currying close relations to the powerful, so you have access to their news. When the powerful are entirely in agreement on an issue, for example, whether or not the U.S. has the right to invade another country, taken as a given by many people in power, the journalists don't ask questions. They reproduce the elite consensus, take it as a given. In fact, if a journalist were to question the right of the U.S. to invade a country, they would be regarded by the professional news community as unprofessional. They would be seen as someone who was bringing their ideological agenda or axe to grind to the discussion. When a journalist dares to question the motives of those in power, they are framed as bringing their own personal political bias into news reporting. But when a journalist just reports and repeats what people in power say, and doesn't try to weigh in with critical observations, they are regarded as professional, fair, and balanced. Editors, particularly those in publicly held corporations whose executives are cautious about reactions on Wall Street, do not have to be ordered to kill stories or slant the coverage. They intuitively understand the views and interests of their bosses and act accordingly. This capacity to anticipate the owner's desires is why they are made editors. Fear-mongering. With their masters cracking the whip, the watchdog media have turned into lapdogs for their corporate and political owners, which in turn has allowed the government to manipulate the public through national fear-mongering. One of the best examples of fear-mongering came in early 2006 when President Bush, under fire for the unresolved wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the torture of terrorist suspects, and unconstitutional spying on Americans, declared, "We cannot let the fact that America hasn't been attacked in 4.5 years since September 11th lull us into the illusion that the threats to our nation have disappeared." Bush then went on to describe a thwarted terrorist attack on Los Angeles in 2002, revealing that the attack in California was planned by a man named Hambali, reportedly a key lieutenant of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged mastermind of the 9/11 attacks. Both Hambali and Mohammed were reportedly captured in 2003. According to Bush, Al-Qaeda leaders Hambali and Mohammed recruited Asian men who were supposed to use shoe bombs to blow open the cockpit door of a commercial airliner and then crash the plane into the U.S. Bank Tower in Los Angeles. Bush mistakenly referred to this building as Liberty Tower, but was quickly corrected that its original name had been Library Tower. Bush said the plot was foiled when a key Asian Al-Qaeda member was arrested. Bush declined to name the suspect or his nationality. Soon this story filled the mass media airwaves as some stations aired scenes from the Hollywood alien invasion film Independence Day as graphic representation of the destruction of the U.S. Bank Tower. But even before Americans could let out their collective sigh of relief at being spared further carnage, serious questions arose over Bush's statement. Many thoughtfully wondered why Bush had not called attention to saving the Los Angeles building early in 2003, soon after the attacks were thwarted and the criminals behind the attacks were captured. If Bush had delivered this news in 2003, he might have helped calm or prevent the large and numerous anti-war demonstrations conducted prior to the invasion of Iraq. Public skepticism increased when Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa told newsmen he knew nothing of the attempted attack and felt blindsided by Bush's announcement. Prior communication with the White House had been non-existent, despite the fact that the mayor had requested to meet with Bush at least 2 times over security issues. "I'm amazed that the president would make this announcement on national TV and not inform us of these details through the appropriate channels," Villaraigosa told newsmen. "I don't expect a call from the president, but somebody." Others were even less considerate when characterizing Bush's breaking news. Doug Thompson, a writer for the internet's oldest political news site, Capitol Hill Blue, said he was contacted by members of the U.S. intelligence community who disputed Bush's claim. Thompson said he was able to confirm the credentials of at least 4 of the persons who contacted him. All of those who contacted him asked not to be identified for fear of reprisals. "The president has cheapened the entire intelligence community by dragging us into his fantasy world," Thompson quoted a longtime CIA operative as saying. "He is basing this absurd claim regarding the Los Angeles attack on the same discredited informant who told us Al-Qaeda would attack selected financial institutions in New York and Washington." Suspiciously enough, during the heat of the presidential election in August 2004, the Bush White House tried to increase the terror alert level by claiming attacks were imminent on major financial institutions. This alert was later withdrawn after administration officials admitted it was based on old information from a discredited source. It has not always been the case that American leaders with a strong siege mentality broadcasted warnings of imminent attack to the public. In a prophetic testimony before joint hearings of the Senate Armed Services Appropriations and Intelligence Committees in the spring of 2001, Colin Powell, then Secretary of State, explained why Americans should not give up their freedoms in search of security. If we adopted this hunkered-down attitude behind our concrete and our barbed wire, the terrorists would have achieved a kind of victory, he declared. This type of reasoned rhetoric changed completely after constitutionally questionable laws and regulations were put into effect after the terrorist attacks in New York City and at the Pentagon later that year. Within days of the 9/11 attacks, President Bush declared a war on terrorism. Patriot Act. Since 9/11, the government has used nationalism as cover for implementing measures to control the population. Secret evidence, closed trials, false imprisonment, warrantless searches, involuntary drugging, the seizing of private property, all seem like something from a 1930s totalitarian regime. But fear has pushed many Americans into a zombie-like passiveness to authority. A shining example of fear-based legislation is a dreadful piece of legislation entitled The Uniting and Strengthening America by Providing Appropriate Tools Required to Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism Act of 2001, more commonly referred to as the Patriot Act. The name is reminiscent of Hitler's 1933 Enabling Act legislation passed hurriedly following the burning of Berlin's Reichstag, its parliament building, in 1933. This law, which founded Hitler's Third Reich, was called the Law to Remove the Distress of the People and State. Similarly, the Patriot Act was 342 pages long and made many changes to more than 15 different U.S. statutes, most of them enacted in the wake of previous misuse of surveillance powers by the FBI and CIA. It was hurriedly signed into law by President George W. Bush on October 26, 2001, a little more than 1 month following the 9/11 attacks. According to some congressmen, many lawmakers had not even read the entire document when it was passed. The ACLU also reported that some members of Congress had less than 1 hour to read the extensive changes of law contained within the act. The speed with which this legislation was presented to Congress caused some observers to believe that it had long been prepared and simply needed some provocation to put it into effect. Civil libertarians felt those two facts alone should be cause for wholesale dismissals of the obliging members of Congress. Representative Ron Paul, who ran for president in 2008, confirmed rumors that the bill was not read by most members of the House prior to their vote. "It's my understanding the bill wasn't printed before the vote. At least I couldn't get it. They played all kinds of games, keeping the House in session all night, and it was a very complicated bill. Maybe a handful of staffers actually read it, but the bill definitely was not available to members before the vote." Paul added he objected to how opponents were stigmatized by the name alone. "The insult is to call this a patriot bill and suggest I'm not patriotic because I insisted upon finding out what was in it and voting no. I thought it was undermining the Constitution, so I didn't vote for it. Therefore, I'm somehow not a patriot. That's insulting." Provisions of the original Patriot Act that most concerned civil libertarians were the following. The federal government may now monitor religious and political institutions without suspecting criminal activity to assist terrorism investigations, a violation of the First Amendment right of association. The feds now can close to the public once open immigration hearings and secretly detain hundreds of people without charge while encouraging bureaucrats to resist freedom of information requests, a violation of Amendments 5 and 6 guaranteeing due process, speedy trials, and freedom of information. The government may prosecute librarians or other keepers of records if they tell anyone that the government subpoenaed information related to a terrorism investigation, a violation of the First Amendment right of free speech. The government now may monitor conversations between federal prisoners and their attorneys and may even deny access to lawyers to Americans accused of crimes, a violation of the Sixth Amendment right to have legal representation. The government now may search and seize individual and business papers and effects without probable cause to assist an anti-terrorism investigation, a violation of the Fourth Amendment right against unreasonable searches and seizures. The government now may jail Americans indefinitely without a trial or charges, a violation of the Sixth Amendment right to a speedy trial and individuals' right to be informed of the charges against them. After later reviewing the act further, Representative Ron Paul said, "The worst part of this so-called anti-terrorism bill is the increased ability of the federal government to commit surveillance on all of us without proper search warrants." This section of the Patriot Act, entitled Authority for Delaying Notice of the Execution of a Warrant, is commonly referred to as the Sneak and Peek provision. It allows authorities to search personal property without warning. Congressman Paul pointed out that the act's supporters were flawed in thinking that the government would act in a restrained and responsible manner. "I don't like the sneak and peek provision because you have to ask yourself, what happens if the person is home? Doesn't know that law enforcement is coming to search his home, hasn't a clue as to who's coming in unannounced, and he shoots them. This law clearly authorizes illegal search and seizure, and anyone who thinks of this as anti-terrorism needs to consider its application to every American citizen." Since the ratification of the Patriot Act, many critics have argued that the surveillance portions are unconstitutional. The Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution states, "The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized." Award-winning investigative reporter Kelly O'Meara spent 16 years working as a congressional staffer to four members of Congress prior to working as an investigative journalist. She holds a B.S. in political science from the University of Maryland and makes her home in Alexandria, Virginia. O'Meara wrote, "With one vote by Congress and the sweep of the president's pen, say critics, the right of every American fully to be protected under the Fourth Amendment against reasonable search and seizures was abrogated." Such perversion of the Constitution was aggravated on March 4, 2010, with the introduction of a bill called the Enemy Belligerent Interrogation, Detention, and Prosecution Act of 2010. This legislation expanded the Bush-era term enemy combatant to enemy belligerent, defined as any individual, including American citizens, suspected of any affiliation with terrorism or supporting hostilities against the United States or its coalition partners. Such suspects under this law must be turned over to military authorities and can be detained without charge, denied the Miranda warning of self-incrimination and legal representation, and held for the duration of the hostilities. Despite Obama's earlier voiced opposition to Bush's Military Commissions Act, he was expected to support this bill, which was introduced by Democratic Senator Joe Lieberman of the CFR and Republican Senator John McCain. Constitutional attorney and author of the New York Times bestseller, How Would a Patriot Act?, Glenn Greenwald called the Enemy Belligerent Act probably the single most extremist, tyrannical, and dangerous bill introduced in the Senate in the last several decades, far beyond the horrendous Habeas Abolishing Military Commissions Act. Laser or Taser? Under statutes within the Patriot Act, David Bannock of Parsippany, New Jersey, was accused in 2005 of using a laser beam to temporarily blind the pilot and co-pilot of a jet plane passing over his house on December 29, 2004. Bannock denied any evil intent and said he was simply using the laser to point out stars for his 7-year-old daughter. Though the airplane landed safely and without incident, and though the FBI found no terrorist connection and acknowledged Bannock's actions were simply foolhardy and negligent, Bannock faced a 25-year prison sentence and a $500,000 fine. Bannock was eventually released from jail after posting $100,000 bail. But then, in early 2006, Bannock was found guilty of violating a portion of the Patriot Act having to do with interfering with pilots of commercial aircraft. He was given a 2-year probated jail sentence. This probation sentence may be understandable, since it was learned that the government was testing a laser system in the same area as Bannock when he was arrested. In early 2005, Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta announced that the U.S. military would activate the ground-based lasers to warn off pilots whenever unauthorized or unresponsive aircraft entered restricted zones in the Northeast. During testing of this system, pilots began to report incidents of lasers being shown into their cockpits. Mineta's announcement came on January 12, 2005, the same day that technical testing of the laser warning system was completed. This means the U.S. government made the public believe that terrorists were testing laser beams to bring down aircraft when, in fact, it was the government testing lasers. Another energy device being widely used by the government is the taser, an electroshock weapon that disrupts voluntary muscle control. Police too often use electric tasers in situations that don't require it, even though some 129 people nationwide have died in connection to the device. The medical examiner in Tarrant County, Texas, Dr. Nizam Pirwani, told the media he believes that tasers are safe. But following 3 deaths in Fort Worth, he said he would like to see more studies done on the taser being used on people who are high on drugs, agitated, or suffering from heart problems. Pirwani said that in at least one case, the death of 17-year-old Kevin Omas, who died after being tasered 3 times by police, he believes the use of the taser was a contributory factor in the death. Police tactics and FEMA. National fear-mongering may have something to do with the rise of a police state in certain locations. Most local police no longer wear the traditional blue uniforms, and the slogan, "to serve and protect," has largely been eliminated from their vehicles. Today, many officers, particularly in the large urban centers, wear black, and in serious situations don body armor and helmets based on the German World War II design. Beginning in 2008, public fears were further heightened when stories appeared on the internet concerning stockpiles of cheap plastic sealable coffins discovered in the country. The stories were documented with photos. One such place, reportedly containing some 500,000 coffins, was in Middle Georgia near the town of Madison, just east of Atlanta, home of the Centers for Disease Control. Then rumors spread about plans for roadblocks, mandatory vaccinations, and quarantine holding centers for those who resisted relocation. Apparently, some rumors were based on information about the changing role of law enforcement. Greg Evanson, a former Kansas State trooper, recalled, "Our nation's police forces, prior to Richard Nixon, were centered on community policing. Most of their time was spent on looking for, identifying, and monitoring criminals and responding to unusual or dangerous events that were beyond the control of ordinary folks. As government began its sickening expansion, policing became a meaner and nastier job. It was made that way by badge-wearing thugs who didn't hesitate to do whatever they were told by the SAC, Special Agent in Charge of the FBI, BATFE, U.S. Marshal's Office, right down to armed poultry inspectors. Yes, they have them, and they are really tough on criminal chickens. The us-against-them mentality and the mission-essential attitude justified SWAT teams, dynamic entries, and later use of mace, tasers, flashbang grenades, and routine use of submachine guns, all in the name of taking down the accused, no matter the charge. Now we have become eavesdropping, roadblock-setting, door-crashing, face-grinding, arm-breaking, pursuit-driven bastards that have sold their asses to the government masters, hell-bent on establishing the true reincarnation of the dreaded SS. This is no overstatement. There are significant numbers of officers at all levels that simply detest the forced training at FEMA centers, the requirements to stop patriots and others simply because they look dangerous and are exercising free speech statements on their vehicles, Evanson added. Evanson referenced stories from other officers who turned whistleblowers and warned, "Have you been made aware of the massive roadblock plans to stop all travelers for a vaccine bracelet, stainless steel band with a microchip on board, that will force you to take a vaccine shot? Refuse it? You will be placed on a prison bus and taken to a quarantine camp. What will you do when your children are not allowed into school without the shot? What will you do when you are not allowed into the workplace without the vaccine paperwork? Buy groceries? Go to the bank? Shop anywhere? Get on a plane, bus, or train? Use the toilet in the mall? Nope. Police officers will become loathed, feared, despised, and remembered for their official duties." Certainly most Americans, lulled by the corporate mass media, must assume Evanson's predictions are paranoid delusions. Yet these Americans should examine the evidence around them. Though many claim fear-mongering is a tactic reserved only for the Bush administration, President Obama did nothing to stop the fear-mongering following his election. In fact, in March 2009, he announced America's new regional strategy, the AFPAC, Afghanistan-Pakistan Theater. Mimicking Bush administration rhetoric, Obama declared, "Multiple intelligence estimates have warned that Al-Qaeda is actively planning attacks on the U.S. homeland from its safe havens in Pakistan." He vowed to send an additional 4,000 troops to train recruits for the Afghan National Army, saying, "I want the American people to understand that we have a clear and focused goal, to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat Al-Qaeda in Pakistan and Afghanistan." This hawkish rhetoric was backed up in late 2009 when Obama increased troop levels in Afghanistan by 30,000 while pledging to begin the withdrawal of U.S. forces in 2011. Little media notice was given to the fact that while attention was focused on Afghanistan and Iraq, Obama quietly was returning an estimated 1 million U.S. troops home to reinforce the new Northern Command, U.S. NORTHCOM, formed under President Bush, to provide command and control of Department of Defense homeland defense efforts and to coordinate defense support of civil authorities. Was Obama anticipating civil unrest? Designated terrorists. Concerns over polarizing the population were raised again in March 2009 after the release of an unclassified reference aid from the Department of Homeland Security's Strategic Analysis Group and the Extremism and Radicalization Branch of the DHS Environment Threat Analysis Division. This aid was aimed not only at department offices but also to assist federal, state, local, and tribal homeland security and law enforcement officials in conducting analytic activities. Apparently, this means aiding lawmen in determining who in Homeland Security's opinion might be considered a terrorist. This document, entitled a Domestic Extremism Lexicon, lists, along with animal rights and environmental extremists, Aryan prison gangs, black nationalists, and neo-Nazis, Cubans, who do not recognize the legitimacy of the communist Cuban government, lone terrorists, Jewish extremists, the patriot and tax resistance movements, and even alternative media, defined as various information sources that provide a forum for interpretations of events and issues that differ radically from those presented in mass media products and outlets. Following a public outcry, the extremist list reportedly was withdrawn, although for how long remains a question. Meanwhile, copies remain on the internet, and some law enforcement officers still recall its words. the federal government is training its enforcers that people who don't believe everything they see on Fox News, CNN, or read in the New York Times are to be treated as a threat and a potential violent domestic terrorist, railed internet commentator and author Paul Joseph Watson. A pamphlet prepared by the Texas Department of Public Safety in 2004 and entitled Terrorism, What the Public Needs to Know, was a recipe for paranoia and witch hunting. It includes these pointers on how to spot a terrorist. We'll employ a variety of vehicles and communicate predominantly by cell phone, email, or text messaging services. Well prepared to spend years in sleeper mode until it is time to attack. In many cases, we'll try to fit in and not draw attention to themselves. May appear normal in their appearance and behavior while portraying themselves as a tourist, student, or business person. May be found traveling in a mixed group of men, women, and children of varying ages who are unaware of their purpose. Trained to avoid confrontations with law enforcement and therefore can be expected to project a nice guy image. Known to use disguises or undergo plastic surgery, especially when featured on police wanted posters. Another example of the emergence of a police state is the quiet but sudden appearance over the past few years of steel cables attached to metal posts in the medians on freeways in and out of major cities. When these concrete strips first appeared, many people thought they were bicycle or jogging paths, but the steel cables revealed their true purpose, a barricade to prevent anyone from making a U-turn. Such impediments have joined the thousands of concrete barriers already in place on most freeways and interstate highways. But was there a huge problem with U-turning traffic to begin with? None that anyone could recall. Then what was the purpose of spending millions of dollars on highways when the economy was at a low ebb? Conspiracy-minded individuals believe that these barriers are in preparation for future roadblocks to prevent city dwellers from leaving town. Anyone caught in line for a checkpoint, similar to those already in use in Los Angeles and other major cities, will find they will be unable to turn around. No other purposes for these barricades have been publicized. Because local police do not have the personnel to administer this level of police state activity, it may be up to the military to take charge, despite the Posse Comitatus Act prohibiting such action. Very little national media coverage was given to the heavy-handed police reaction against protesters at the late September 2009 G20 meetings in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Frustrated at not being able to approach the meeting place, some 2,000 demonstrators, called anti-capitalists by one news report, clashed with black-clad helmeted police armed with dogs, gas, rubber pellet-filled shotgun charges called beanbags, and advanced technologies like long-range acoustic device, LRAD, sonic cannons. Allegations that violence at the G20 was initiated by government agent provocateurs were supported by YouTube videos of a supposed black-clad anarchist posing for photos with grinning police officers. Officials later claimed the youth in the video was forced to pose by the men in riot gear. During the same G20 protests, 200 people were arrested and dozens of bystanders, including passing students and journalists, were gassed near the Oakland Thomas Merton Center, a city center containing several universities, museums, and hospitals, as well as an abundance of stores and restaurants. Many complained that the crisis was akin to a military-style occupation. The police were beating people and gassing people who were wandering out of restaurants, wandering out of their dorms, said Nigel Perry, a journalist with Twin Cities Indie Media. Another journalist, Melissa Hall, said police erased her video footage and damaged her camera. "This was unjust," complained 23-year-old Nathan Lanzendorfer. "I was peaceful. I'd done nothing wrong." Lanzendorfer showed newsmen large purple spots on his legs and one arm where he said police shot him at close range with beanbag rounds. Elizabeth Pittenger, executive director of the city's Citizen Police Review Board, said her group had received 50 complaints about the police and that the board would conduct a comprehensive investigation of the police response. She was very disturbed over the arrest of journalists, including Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter Sadie Gurman. The country's police state mentality has trickled down to those who do not even hold status as actual police officers, and at times even jeopardizes the public's basic rights as guaranteed by the Constitution. For example, a video taken at an August 2009 town hall meeting in Reston, Virginia, and placed on the internet, shows an unnamed man being ordered to lower a sign depicting President Obama with a clown face, presumably to make him look like the Joker, a character from the popular Batman franchise. Wesley Cheeks Jr., a school security officer, ordered the man to lower his sign. When the demonstrator argued that he was only exercising his constitutional rights, Cheeks threatened him with arrest. "This used to be America," the man groused, typifying the change in the attitude of police who once considered themselves servants of the people. The officer responded, "Well, it ain't no more, okay?" Obama's School Talk. When kindergartners in B. Bernice Young School sang a medley of two short songs praising the president in February 2009, alarm bells went off among many who are concerned about the globalists' control of media over what they perceived as undue worship of a public leader. Then in October of that year, President Obama addressed the nation's school children directly. Many school districts declined to broadcast President Obama's remarks to America's youth because they felt the president intended to use his office to politicize public school classrooms with training materials. The training materials produced by the U.S. Department of Education's Teaching Ambassador Fellows and handed out to pre-kindergartners through 12th graders stated, "Before the speech, teachers can build background knowledge about the President of the United States and his speech by reading books about presidents and Barack Obama, and motivate students by asking the following questions. Who is the President of the United States? What do you think it takes to be president? To whom do you think the president is going to be speaking? Why do you think he wants to speak to you? What do you think he will say to you?" Other topics of discussion in these materials included, "Why is it important that we listen to the president and other elected officials like the mayor, senators, members of Congress, or the governor? Why is what they say important?" Republicans argued over what they saw as political propaganda in the talk's preparatory materials, such as the brochure's suggestion for students to write letters to themselves about what they can do to help the president. In this case, wording was changed to write letters to themselves about how they can achieve their short-term and long-term education goals. "We changed it to clarify the language so the intent is clear," explained White House spokesman Tommy Viator. Nevertheless, a number of parents objected to a president having access to all school children. Regine Gordon of Tampa, Florida, and mother of a 6-year-old student, told newsmen, "It's a form of indoctrination, and I think, really, it's indicative of the culture that the Obama administration is trying to create. It's very socialistic. It's kind of like going through the children to get to their parents. Children are very vulnerable and excited. I mean, this is the president. I think it's an underhanded tactic and indicative of the way things are being done." One Texas school district declined to make listening to Obama school talk mandatory. The superintendent sent a memo to all teachers explaining, "The decision not to require all students pre-K to grade 12 to watch the speech together in school was based on the following concerns. 1. The federal and state school accountability systems are so demanding that it is difficult to defend stopping instruction for any reason. School districts, campuses, and now teachers are being compared based on student performance. The changing system and increasing demand for results requires everyone to focus on the instructional mission at all times. 2. It is difficult to comprehend that anyone could make a single presentation that was equally meaningful to pre-K students and seniors in high school. 3. The timing of a first day speech 2.5 weeks into the school year is less than ideal. 4. The time of day the speech was scheduled creates a number of potential scheduling issues for each campus. These challenges would have ultimately cost the district a full day of instruction. 5. School districts have not stopped instruction at all grade levels to watch a speech in the past. 6. Communication about the speech and lead time provided to school districts was less than ideal. 7. It is difficult to show anything to a classroom of students that you have not previewed prior to the demonstration. A one-time speech is clearly different than a ceremonial event like an inauguration. 8. The speech has been presented as an optional and not required event. But other school districts were not as lenient as the one in Texas. The superintendent of School District No. 3 in Tempe, Arizona, Dr. Arthur Tate Jr., stated parents would not be permitted to pull their children out of class during Obama's speech. "I have directed principals to have students and teachers view the president's message on Tuesday," stated Tate. "In some cases, where technology will not permit access to the White House website, DVDs will be provided to classes on subsequent days. I am not permitting parents to opt out students from viewing the president's message, since this is a purely educational event." The fact that a president, and one who was surrounded by so much controversy, would address all of the nation's school children renewed the concerns of many Americans over the security of American values. For example, many saw Obama's nationwide talk to children and his call for involuntary service as ominous signs of indoctrinating the youth. Many even compared all this to the Hitler Youth movement practiced in Nazi Germany. The controversy over Obama's talk to school children renewed the earlier criticism over songs about the president being taught to the B. Bernice Young School kindergarten children. As news about the song gained nationwide attention, the New Jersey Department of Education issued a mild rebuke. Spokeswoman Beth Auerswald said the department desired to ensure students can celebrate the achievements of African Americans during Black History Month without inappropriate partisan politics in the classroom. The teacher involved retired. Leader control. You cannot help the poor by destroying the rich. You cannot strengthen the weak by weakening the strong. You cannot bring about prosperity by discouraging thrift. You cannot lift the wage earner up by pulling the wage payer down. You cannot further the brotherhood of man by inciting class hatred. You cannot build character and courage by taking away people's initiative and independence. You cannot help people permanently by doing for them what they could and should do for themselves. William J.H. Betker, Presbyterian minister, often erroneously attributed to Abraham Lincoln. Early in his presidency, Barack Obama found himself caught in a triangle of misstatements and reversals of promises. His promise for a change in politics rang hollow, and many of his former supporters felt betrayed. Obama was caught in one falsehood after another, backing down on his campaign promise to dismantle the U.S. missile defense system. Then, in late 2009, he reversed his promised reversal, putting the system back on track. As mentioned earlier, manufactured aides. In a statement revealing the ongoing reach of the globalists, Obama's national security advisor, General James L. Jones, told attendees at a Munich security conference, "As the most recent national security advisor of the United States, I take my daily orders from Dr. Kissinger, filtered down through General Brent Scowcroft and Sandy Berger, who was also here. We have a chain of command in the National Security Council that exists today." Kissinger is one man widely viewed as the architect of a U.S. foreign policy that has turned foreign extremists into implacable enemies. Strangely enough, Obama was selected to receive the Nobel Peace Prize in October 2009. The corporate mass media, which thirsted for good news during a bad economy, publicized the announcement widely. But as Nancy Gibbs, writing for Time magazine, observed, The last thing Barack Obama needed at this moment in his presidency and our politics is a prize for a promise. She noted that when reality bites, it chomps down hard, because none of Obama's political goals had been accomplished a year after his election. Gibbs said, "A prize for even dreaming them can feed the illusion that they have." Gibbs compared Obama's failed promises with the accomplishments of another Nobel Prize candidate, Greg Mortensen. The son of a missionary, Mortensen is a former Montana mountaineer and was nominated by the U.S. Congress for his humanitarian work in building 130 schools for girls in Muslim countries hostile to education for women. "Sometimes the words come first. Sometimes it's better to let action speak for themselves," mused Gibbs. The prize especially angered those who saw Barack Obama as a peace candidate when he only increased spending in Iraq after being elected. In late 2009, the Obama administration announced plans to send an additional 30,000 troops to Afghanistan. In fact, Obama's total military expenditures have grown at a greater rate than those under George W. Bush, almost universally considered a hawk president. Obama's reversal of his campaign pledge to dismantle the U.S. missile defense system meant that the United States would continue to aim nuclear missiles at Moscow from Poland, Ukraine, and perhaps Georgia. It should be noted that the Obama administration waffled several times over the controversial missile system. In 2008, the Obama campaign stated its opposition to a program that many saw as merely a continuation of the old Star Wars program of the Reagan years. But in early 2009, Vice President Joe Biden told a European audience the United States would continue the missile defense system after consulting with NATO countries and assuring Russia the weapons are only meant for Iran. Russia has long perceived the program as a threat to its security. Later that year, both Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and President Obama backpedaled in an attempt to use the missile defense system as an incentive for Iran to discontinue its nuclear program. They suggested that the missile system might be shelved depending on Iran's actions. By the fall of 2009, it seemed as if the missile defense system was doomed. Despite news that a stockpile of nuclear weapons had been discovered in Iran, on September 17th, the White House announced it was scrapping the strategic missile defense system in favor of smaller SM-3 interceptors capable of intercepting Iranian missiles. According to the New York Times, the decision was one of the biggest national security reversals of Obama's young presidency. The reversal created both confusion among Eastern European allies and anger from conservatives who accused Obama of caving in to objections from the Russians. Typically, Obama appeared to be trying to placate both sides, saying, "President Bush was right that Iran's ballistic missile program poses a significant threat. This new approach will provide capabilities sooner, build on proven systems, and offer greater defenses against the threat of missile attack than the 2007 European missile defense program." The brouhaha over the missile defense system represents a small glimpse into the power struggles taking place between globalists eager for higher defense budgets and hence more defense profits, and those who are trying to push their one-world socialist agenda by merging the nations. A Council Cabinet. To analyze the truth about the Obama administration, it is instructive to look behind his rhetoric at the individuals and groups that shape his administration. Many believe that Obama's cabinet members have ties to secretive societies that may have orchestrated the present economic recession. People in Obama's cabinet who are members of the Council on Foreign Relations include Defense Secretary Robert Gates, Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano, Commerce Secretary Bill Richardson, UN Ambassador Susan Rice, National Security Advisor General James L. Jones, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, Economic Advisor Paul Volcker, and Director of the National Economic Council, L.H. Summers. Many of these same names, plus others, appear on the roster of the Trilateral Commission, co-founded in 1973 by Zbigniew Brzezinski and David Rockefeller. Alan Greenspan and Paul Volcker, both of whom went on to head the Federal Reserve System, also were founding members of the commission. Brzezinski, a former chairman of the commission, was Obama's principal foreign policy advisor during the 2008 campaign, and it was generally accepted that trilateral members groomed Obama for office. The Trilateral Commission is generally considered a spin-off organization of the Council on Foreign Relations that was designed to include Asian nations. Additional trilateralists in the Obama administration include Tim Geithner, Susan Rice, the Deputy National Security Advisor, Thomas Donilon, the Director of National Intelligence, Admiral Dennis C. Blair, the Assistant Secretary of State for Asia and the Pacific, Kurt M. Campbell, the Deputy Secretary of State, James Steinberg, and State Department Special Envoys Richard Haass, Dennis Ross, and Richard Holbrooke. According to official Trilateral Commission membership lists, there are only 87 members from the United States. The other 337 members are from other countries. Thus, within 2 weeks of his inauguration, Obama's appointments encompassed more than 12% of the commission's entire U.S. membership, noted researchers at Project Censored. Patrick Wood, author of the Project Censored paper, Obama Trilateral Commission Endgame, stated, "The concept of undue influence comes to mind when considering the number of Trilateral Commission members in the Obama administration. They control the areas of our most urgent national needs: financial and economic crisis, national security, and foreign policy. The conflict of interest is glaring. With 75% of the trilateral membership consisting of non-U.S. individuals, what influence does this supermajority have on the remaining 25%? For example, when Chrysler entered bankruptcy under the oversight and control of the Obama administration, it was quickly decided that the Italian carmaker Fiat would take over Chrysler. The deal's point man, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, is a member of the Trilateral Commission. Would you be surprised to know that the chairman of Fiat, Luca di Montezemolo, is also a fellow member? Congress should have halted this deal the moment it was suggested." In his book, With No Apologies, the late Senator Barry Goldwater described the commission with distrust. "In my view, the Trilateral Commission represents a skillful, coordinated effort to seize control and consolidate the four centers of power: political, monetary, intellectual, and ecclesiastical. All this is to be done in the interest of creating a more peaceful, more productive world community. What the trilateralists truly intend is the creation of a worldwide economic power superior to the political governments of the nation-states involved. They believe the abundant materialism they propose to create will overwhelm existing differences. As managers and creators of the system, they will rule the future." Trilateralists and others within globalist societies have displayed very little concern for the United States as a sovereign nation. Their policies often run counter to the best interests of the United States and, in fact, appear to support the allegation that they seek a one-world government. A comfortable staff. It may be that President Obama is connected to too many of the nation's elite globalists to affect policy in any one direction without appearing hypocritical. He also came under fire for perceived conflicts of interest, such as the time he golfed with Robert Wolf, president of UBS Investment Bank, and the chairman and CEO of UBS Group Americas. Wolf had been an early supporter of Obama and had raised $250,000 for his campaign back in 2006. Moreover, according to ProPublica reporter Sharona Coots and Stephen Cohn, executive director of the National Whistleblower Center, their golf game took place only 3 days after UBS had reached an agreement with the IRS to give up the names of 4,500 American clients suspected of hiding billions in secret Swiss bank accounts. This was done in an effort to avoid criminal charges. UBS already had admitted to aiding the clients in tax evasion and agreed to pay a $780 million fine. In February 2009, Wolf was appointed to the President's Economic Recovery Advisory Board, tasked with trying to fix America's new depression. What is perhaps both ironic and tragic about the UBS situation is that the man who had been the whistleblower on UBS's shady dealings was sentenced to a 40-month prison sentence. As a UBS banker involved with the Swiss accounts, Bradley Birkenfeld had initiated the investigation. It was Birkenfeld's disclosures and cooperation with authorities that provided inside information into the bank's conduct and allowed the government to gain $780 million in fines and stop a massive tax evasion scheme. Yet, for his trouble, Birkenfeld was given a harsher sentence by Fort Lauderdale federal judge Williams Locke than was asked for by the case's prosecutors. Stephen Cohn pointed out that while the government announced it would investigate the 4,500 names handed over by UBS, Birkenfeld had actually turned in 52,000 account identifications. But the whole case is puzzling, Cohn added, because if the United States wants to crack tax fraud, if they want to crack money laundering or stop these practices in secret banks, why are they putting into prison for 40 months the whistleblower? The billionaire to whom he was serving got probation. How are they ever going to get another banker to step forward and cooperate with an investigation? But it was not just Obama's corporate buddies that raised the ire of many citizens. His wife took flack, as more outrage resulted from the news of First Lady Michelle Obama's well-paid staff. No, Michelle Obama does not get paid to serve as the First Lady, and she doesn't perform any official duties. But this hasn't deterred her from hiring an unprecedented number of staffers to cater to her every whim and to satisfy her every request in the midst of the Great Recession, wrote Dr. Paul L. Williams in the Canada Free Press. Just think, Mary Lincoln was taken to task for purchasing China for the White House during the Civil War, and Mamie Eisenhower had to shell out the salary for her personal secretary. Williams quoted Mrs. Obama's statement from the Democratic National Convention. In my own life, in my own small way, I've tried to give back to this country that has given me so much. See, that's why I left a job at a big law firm for a career in public service. Paul Williams then lamented, if you're one of the tens of millions of Americans facing certain destitution, earning less than subsistence wages on stocking the shelves at Walmart or serving up McDonald's cheeseburgers, prepare to scream and then come to realize that the benefit package for these servants of Ms. Michelle are the same as members of the National Security and Defense Departments, and the bill for these assorted lackeys is paid by John Q. Public. The listing of White House staffers assigned to the First Lady and their salaries made ripples through the Internet. They included Susan Schur, Chief of Staff, $172,200. Jocelyn C. Fry, Deputy Assistant to the President and Director of Policy and Projects for the First Lady, $140,000. Desiree G. Rogers, Special Assistant to the President and White House Social Secretary, $113,000. Camille Y. Johnston, Special Assistant to the President and Director of Communications for the First Lady, $102,000. Melissa E. Winter, Special Assistant to the President and Deputy Chief of Staff to the First Lady, $100,000. David S. Medina, Deputy Chief of Staff to the First Lady, $90,000. Catherine M. Lelleveld, Director and Press Secretary to the First Lady, $84,000. Francis M. Starkey, Director of Scheduling and Advance for the First Lady, $75,000. Trooper Sanders, Deputy Director of Policy and Projects for the First Lady, $70,000. Aaron J. Burno, Deputy Director and Deputy Social Secretary, $65,000. Joseph B. Reinstein, Deputy Director and Deputy Social Secretary, $64,000. Jennifer R. Goodman, Deputy Director of Scheduling and Events Coordinator for the First Lady, $62,000. Alan O. Fitz, Deputy Director of Advance and Trip Director for the First Lady, $60,000. Dana M. Lewis, Special Assistant and Personal Aide to the First Lady, $57,500. Sermonti M. Mustafi, Associate Director and Deputy Press Secretary to the First Lady, $52,500. Kristen E. Jarvis, Special Assistant for Scheduling and Traveling Aide to the First Lady, $50,000. Tyler A. Lechtenberg, Associate Director of Correspondence for the First Lady, $45,000. Samantha Tubman, Deputy Associate Director, Social Office, $43,000. Joseph J. Boswell, Executive Assistant to the Chief of Staff to the First Lady, $40,000. Sally M. Armbruster, Staff Assistant to the Social Secretary, $36,000. Natalie Bookie, Staff Assistant, $35,000. Delia A. Jackson, Deputy Associate Director of Correspondence for the First Lady, $35,000. Williams noted this list did not include makeup artist Ingrid Grimes Miles, age 49, and first hairstylist Johnny Wright, 31, both of whom traveled to Europe with the Obamas aboard Air Force One. While to many, the First Lady's staff seems excessively large, Michelle Obama's staff is not unprecedented, but rather on a par with her predecessors, according to the internet fact-checking site Snopes.com. Though Michelle Obama has more than 20 staffers working for her, the 2008 White House staff list included 16 names working for First Lady Laura Bush. Helping Hamas terrorists. Many believed Obama's policy of unrestrained illegal immigration would destroy the last vestiges of national cohesion, especially when he issued Presidential Determination No. 2009-15, entitled Unexpected Urgent Refugee and Migration Needs Related to Gaza. In early 2009, alternative news outlets reported that Obama actually was aiding immigration through organizations formally linked to terrorism, such as the Islamic Resistance Movement, Hamas. In Presidential Determination No. 2009-15, sent to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in January 2009, Obama claimed authority under the Migration and Refugee Assistance Act of 1962 to spend up to $20.3 million from the United States Emergency Refugee and Migration Assistance Fund for assistance in relocating Palestinian refugees and conflict victims in Gaza to the United States. Though Obama's action received little notice in the corporate mass media, it nevertheless stirred up both the anti-Obama crowd as well as the pro-Israel lobby. Such actions play into the hands of those who decry Obama as pro-Muslim. They remember the words of Libya's Muammar Gaddafi, who in 2008 said, "There are elections in America now. Along came a black citizen of Kenyan African origins, a Muslim, who had studied in an Islamic school in Indonesia. His name is Obama. All the people in the Arab and Islamic world and in Africa applauded this man. They welcomed him and prayed for him and for his success, and they may have been involved in legitimate contribution campaigns to enable him to win the American presidency." Obama's civilian army. Any viable socialist system has needed to indoctrinate its citizenry and use government snitches to gather intelligence. Under President Obama, the United States is no different. President Obama and his chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, have tried to create a 7 million-person civilian army reportable to only the president. In July 2008, Obama stated, "We cannot continue to rely on our military in order to achieve the national security objectives that we've set. We've got to have a civilian national security force that's just as powerful, just as strong, just as well-funded." In 2008, Obama's official campaign website, change.gov, announced that President-elect Obama would expand national service programs like AmeriCorps and the Peace Corps and create a new classroom corps to help teachers in low-income schools. Additionally, Obama planned to create a new health corps, clean energy corps, and veterans corps for his civilian army. Originally, change.gov stated, "Obama will call on citizens of all ages to serve America by developing a plan to require 50 hours of community service in middle school and high school and 100 hours of community service in college every year." Following a barrage of criticism over drafting children into Obama's National Security Force, the website's wording was softened to read, Obama will call on citizens of all ages to serve America by setting a goal that all middle school and high school students do 50 hours of community service a year and be developing a plan so that all college students who conduct 100 hours of community service receive a universal and fully refundable tax credit, ensuring that the first $4,000 of their college education is completely free. Some critics, such as those writing for WorldNetDaily.com and Modern Conservative, found Obama's civilian security force reminiscent of Hitler's brown shirts, the Hitler Youth, and youth brigades in Russia and other communist countries. Scarier words came from Obama's chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel. In his 2006 book, The Plan, Big Ideas for America, Emanuel wrote, "It is time for a real Patriot Act that brings out the patriot in all of us. We propose universal civilian service for every young American. Under this plan, all Americans between the ages of 18 and 25 will be asked to serve their country by going through 3 months of basic training, civil defense preparation, and community service." Due to public resistance, such a plan for universal civilian service languished until passage of Obama's health care plan, euphemistically called the Patient Protection Affordable Care Act, on March 23, 2010. The Senate version, adopted by the House, included a provision for establishing both a National Health Service Corps as well as a Ready Reserve appointed by the President. The purpose of the Ready Reserve was to meet a perceived need for additional commissioned Corps personnel available on short notice, similar to the Uniformed Services Reserve Program, to assist regular commissioned Corps personnel to meet both routine public health and emergency response missions. Is this Obama's civilian army? ACORN and SEIU. Zombies like to flock together in packs or large crowds under the control of a master. In the horror movies, one rarely saw a zombie roaming about alone. Today, American zombies prefer to gather in large groups, and they too are likely to follow some master, whether it be a gang boss, guru, or political chieftain. Political leaders do not work alone. Rather, they are surrounded by staffs, mentors, guides, advisors, and other string pullers, and they have minions working for them in the form of nonprofit organizations. Liberals during the 2000 presidential election accused Bush's Republican supporters of Nazi-style stormtrooper tactics when they surrounded and occupied a building conducting a recount vote in Palm Beach County, Florida. But those who cause problems haven't always sat on the right side of the political fence. Another example of stormtrooper tactics can be seen in an attack by a Service Employees International Union, or SEIU, member on Kenneth Gladney, a young black man who was trying to distribute small flags with a Revolutionary War motto on them at a St. Louis Tea Party meeting. According to Gladney's attorney, David B. Brown, Kenneth was approached by an SEIU representative as Kenneth was handing out "Don't Tread on Me" flags to other conservatives. The SEIU representative demanded to know why a black man was handing out these flags. The SEIU member used a racial slur against Kenneth and then punched him in the face. Kenneth fell to the ground. Another SEIU member yelled racial epithets at Kenneth as he kicked him in the head and back. Kenneth was also brutally attacked by one other male SEIU member and an unidentified woman. Also consider the recent activities of ACORN, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, SEIU, and the political action group Move On. In 2009, the Census Bureau enlisted ACORN to promote the 2010 census, already under criticism for marking individual homes with Global Positioning System, GPS satellite coordinates. Census Director Robert Groves, in a letter to ACORN President Maud Hurd, stated that the community organization had become a distraction. ACORN National Deputy Director Brian Kettenring said, "We will continue to do what we've said we'll do, which is encourage people in communities to participate fully in the census." On September 11, 2009, the U.S. Census Bureau discontinued its partnership with Acorn in the 2010 census after hidden camera videos recorded four Acorn employees giving tax advice on running a brothel. Furor arose after a young activist named James O'Keefe posed as an aspiring politician and told Acorn workers he planned to use his girlfriend's prostitution income to fund future campaigns. He claimed to want advice on how to obtain a loan for a house from which to conduct her profession. In the videos, Acorn workers gave instructions for creating a company in order to prove they had enough income for a house that could serve as a brothel and home for teenage prostitutes. After secretly filming at the Acorn's Baltimore office and later in Washington, D.C., the activists posted the videos on YouTube. Acorn officials said the four offending workers were fired. Yet, despite the terminations and assurances from the president and the executive director of Acorn Housing that Acorn Housing staff members are expected to behave ethically and comply with the law, a growing number of Republican politicians began calling for congressional hearings and IRS audits of Acorn. After the Acorn videos were released on YouTube, the Senate voted 83-7 to block the Housing and Urban Development Department, HUD, from giving grants to Acorn, which ended housing and community funding to the organization. This meant that Acorn would not receive grants for programs such as counseling low-income people on how to get mortgages and for fair housing education and outreach. Only 3 days after the Senate stopped Acorn funds, the House followed suit, voting 345-75, the nays being all Democrats, to deny the organization all federal funds. Acorn has violated serious federal laws, and today the House voted to ensure that taxpayer dollars would no longer be used to fund this corrupt organization, remarked Republican Representative Eric Cantor of Virginia. Most caring Americans agreed that, although it is noble to try to help the poorer segments of our society, it is counterproductive, even outrageous, to support groups with taxpayer money who commit corrupt and unlawful acts, as well as preach hatred of the United States, causing further division within the nation. This division plays right into the hands of the globalist fascists who, through their control of the mass media and party politics, placed Obama in office and were using his supporters to advance their socialist agenda.